Okay. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to week two of the series, Effective Living. First of all, just an announcement. We, on the 30th of April, we're having a two-week Kabbalah meditation course at night for both men and women, the Kabbalah of the Ten Commandments. So if you can book into the office, if you're interested to come, it's 2 weeks until the 30th of April. Today, before we actually launch into the continuation of the topic, which is effective and motivated living, and today we're going to talk about reclaiming the conscious mind, I want to just share a thought, which I think is appropriate for today, and also link it into what we do here on a Thursday morning in general, and particularly in this series. Last week we also began by talking about the victims of the Shoah and so on. But today I want to just reflect on the miracles of the 70-year miracles of Israel, the modern-day Israel, our holy land, right? And I think one of the things that we always need to be conscious of and think about around this time particularly is the true and great miracles that have happened, particularly over the last 70 years, starting from the War of Independence and so on, and all development of the country of Israel, the state of Israel as it is today. Open miracles. And I think sometimes it's easy to forget them because we just take things for granted. That's generally in life the way it is. That's why every day in the Amidah we have something called Modim, where we thank God for the Nifla'otecha, the wonders that He does for us on a daily basis. Because we get used to things, so we start taking them for granted. And as things, time goes on, we take things more and more for granted. But if we examine history and we understand the development of Israel, the wars of Israel, the victories of Israel, I should say, more importantly, we understand the tremendous hand of God, the supernatural hand of God, whether it's Independence War, the Six-Day War, all the other tremendous gifts and amazing miracles that have taken place. The just development, the progress, the technological progress, whatever it is, and the reconnection of the Jewish people to the land of Israel. And I say reconnection because obviously one of the things that's important to emphasize is it's not a connection, it's a reconnection, because it's intrinsically a land that is our land for over 3,000 years and perhaps more. I've shared with you before, but that's a picture of Ir David, where I spent some time, not this past December, but the one before, and I never stopped thinking about it, of how incredible it was to stand on land and to see the pathways and to touch walls that are 3,000 years old, to be in the place where King David wrote the Tehillim, where King Solomon, to stand next to the spring where King Solomon was anointed, and to see the line of travel where Abraham traveled from Be'er Sheva to Jerusalem, to know the exact spot, looking up Temple Mount, where Abraham traveled for the Akedah, something that we mention every single day in our prayers, dozens of times in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And when I was there, I think I shared this with you before, but when I was there, it was the very time where the UN was questioning the Jewish connection to places like the Kotel and the other holy sites. And I just was standing there at Ir David thinking of how stupid and bizarre and how crazy this is. And the only thing we can do is continuously remind ourselves that as we mark and we acknowledge the great hand of God over the last 70 years, we need to do it in context. In the context that is, it's not something that's just recent, it's something that is really intrinsically ancient. Intrinsically ancient, that is ours and belongs to us, and is something that is ours to the very core and the very DNA of Jewish existence. And I wanted to connect that to what we're doing now on Thursday morning, because there's a Kabbalistic concept that there's a land of Israel within every single person. The word Eretz Israel, which means the land of Israel, right? The word Eretz comes from the word Ratzon, to want, to be motivated, the drive, to want to be connected to God, want to be a good person, a spiritual person, and so on and so forth. And just like Eretz Israel of today in the physical sense, a place that needs to be sometimes conquered, or reconquered, or reconnected it to, and so on and so forth. But it's not conquering or settling or, God forbid, occupying a place which is not ours, but rather a place which is ours. The same thing goes for our own personal Israel. Because we have within us a spark, a ratzon, an eretz, But sometimes to reveal it, we have to work hard. We have to invest. Like we said last week from Rabbi Twersky, change is possible, but change is hard. And sometimes it comes with a struggle, a fight, a war, an internal war, an internal struggle. But we win that war because we know it's a winnable war. We win the war because we know that actually we have it anyway. It's there. It's not a war to create something new. It's a war to create or to reveal something that is intrinsically there. So I thought that was a nice connection. I thought I'd share that with you before we get into today's topic. Now, we started a series last week based on the works of Rabbi Twersky in his book, Effective Living. Also, I'm going to come back to the article by Chloe Madanis about the 14 ways of being miserable. We'll come back to that more next week, probably. But he based himself in the book on the concept that change is hard, but change is possible. And we talked last week about the concept that when we change, change means to change our emotions, because our personality lives in the world of emotion, because our personality is very much connected with how we respond to the outside world, to experiences, to people, to the environment around us. Right? Now, just a bit of review. Last week we talked about the concept that Rabbi Twersky explains to us, that there's the three levels of the mind: conscious, pre-conscious, and subconscious, which I'm going to turn around soon, as you suggested last week. But just to review, the idea was that the subconscious is like a hard drive, the hard drive that stores everything that's ever happened to us in a subconscious way. And it's irrational. It's the world of the irrational, and therefore it's a world which creates tricks of the mind. It fools us and creates false realities, sometimes erroneously, to protect us, or we think it's to protect us. For example, the fabricating reality, or taking a dislike to someone because the person looks like someone else. Subconsciously, we make an association. It can be triggering anger in the most irrational way because of association with a negative experience. So we come across something, the experience is not bad, but somehow connects subconsciously to something that might have happened decades ago and triggers sort of an irritation or an anger. Fabricates realities in order to protect us, like the alarm clock story I told you last week. You know, we all agreed that we've all experienced this at some point, where you put an alarm clock but then you dream that it's ringing because you don't really want to get up. Denial is a big one. The subconscious creates a denial where we actually really deny realities because it's too hard to confront difficult situations. Or things like disproportionate anxiety, where we get so nervous about something in a disproportionate way because somehow it links to something which we've experienced in the past. So all these different things. And often what it does is it acts in an erratic, irrational way and does it to protect self-interest, but it's the self-interest which is done incorrectly and has more to do with self-centeredness than the real truth of how we're supposed to behave and operate. So what we explained last week, and this is just a brief review, is that the first step is to always be aware of these irrational subconscious tricks or influences, because when we are aware of it, at least we know it's happening, and therefore we can start engaging in proper strategies and effective strategies. So let's develop it today a little bit, this idea. And what I want to do is have a look at an idea that comes out of a particular chapter in Rabbi Twersky's book, but I want to give a bit of an introduction and elaborate a little bit. So just as an introduction, if we take the human function, not behavior, but the way our mind and emotions work, let's divide it into a different three state. Let's put subconscious there on the top. Number two would be conscious, which would include pre-conscious. In other words, the things that I'm aware of, either right now or this morning or tomorrow. And then emotions of how we react to the outside world. Okay. The important thing to understand of how we work and why sometimes our emotions go out of control, or for example, to use the article I spoke about last week, how we engage in practices which will bring us unhappiness despite the fact that we're obsessed with being happy, and yet we engage in unhealthy emotional responses which actually cause anger or irritation or unhappiness rather than being happy, is because the number one and number three link up. Why do they link up? Because what's equal with the subconscious and the emotional part of our existence is that they're both irrational. Logic lives in the conscious. irrationality lives both in the subconscious and in the world of emotions, because the world of emotions are impulsive, reactive, chaotic, and it just doesn't, our emotions left alone without the guidance of the healthy conscious mind, our emotions will just go all over the place and they operate in a way that is illogical and chaotic. Now, just to explain this a little bit, let me just share with you a Kabbalistic idea, and that is like this. We are taught in the works of Kabbalah that when God created the universe, and when I say God created the universe, I don't mean only this physical world, because we believe that there are other worlds as well. There are spiritual worlds, spiritual existences. There's a whole layer. There's a concept in Kabbalah called Seder Hishtalshelut, which means the evolution of the worlds, one world after another, the spiritual, the metaphysical, and so on and so forth. But we are taught that He created two existences. That before our existence, He created a reality called Olam HaTohu, the world of chaos. In fact, if you open up Genesis and you read the first few verses, it says exactly, it was Tohu Vavohu, that the world before God created was, existence was chaotic and empty, right? Now, if you look at that verse, it's actually talking about once existence exists already. Right, Bereshit, in the beginning when God created the world, there was the heaven and the earth, va'aretz, and the land was chaotic, meaning there was already creation. So it was, but this Kabbalah explains, refers to a creation of a chaotic existence. Following that chaotic existence, which apparently exploded and didn't sort of work in a proper way, and the residue of that chaotic existence is left in our world, but our world is not a chaotic existence. Our world is what's called Olam HaTikun, the world of order, the world of logic, the world of order. Now, we are taught that in God's reality, the spiritual existence that He created, the reality of chaos and the reality of order, chaos is more a world of emotion, impulsivity, and so on, and the world of tikkun is more of a rational and logical world, right? Now, we, human beings, we know we are created, what we call B'Tselem Elokim, we're created in the image of God. In other words, the microcosm of the individual reflects the macrocosm of creation, really, and God's creation and God's manifestations and so on. So therefore, we have within ourselves also the world of chaos and the world of order. And essentially, the world of chaos really lives in the animal part of who we are, and the world of order lives more in the godly part of who we are. Now, an example of the chaotic part of who we are is, just to give an example so we understand it a bit, is like a child with undeveloped maturity, right? One thing that happens with a child when they're born is that a child is full of emotion. There's no problem with emotion. Children love, they hate, they get angry, they get happy. Emotions are very full. In fact, the emotions of a child are sometimes a lot stronger, not mature, but a lot stronger than that of an adult. The problem is, in the world of a child, it's completely the world of chaos. They can love someone 1 second, the next day they can hate them, the next minute they can hate them, they can come back and love them in a minute. I've given this example many, many times. Children can almost kill each other, the parents don't know what to do, the parents are still figuring out what to do, and the children are playing like best friends, right? And the children, and the parent is still saying, what do I do about sibling rivalry? I've often told parents I've never ever figured it out, and I've given up, because it doesn't matter anyways. The only one that suffers is the parents, not the children. I'm talking about little children now, right? Why? Because it's a chaotic world. It's completely impulsive, no logic. There's no knowing when they're going to get upset, they're not going to get upset. We just hope that as they get older, they start to mature and they grow out of it. But it doesn't happen sometimes, sometimes it doesn't. But but it's supposed to happen that way anyways, right? So what's the idea? Why does actually God do that? So why does the world of chaos come before the world of order? Because there's something very great about the world of chaos, which you have to remember. There's something amazing, to use the analogy of a child, there's something amazing about the childlike emotion that actually you don't want to lose, you just want to harness. Often what happens is, as children go up, we steer them to mature, but sometimes wrongly. What we do is we actually dull their emotions rather than channel their emotions. Their emotions are amazing, and the emotions in the purest form are beautiful. So as people grow up, you know, sometimes we talk about the child within us, right? The child within the adult. The child within the adult is an amazing thing. We don't always harness it properly. But there's something beautiful about childlike emotion which we have to keep. It's just, we need to bring it into the world of order and start steering it in the right direction so it's guided by mature intellect, which can only happen as a child gets older, because that's when the brain develops. What a child doesn't have is the maturity of intellect, the maturity of consciousness. But emotions they have, right? So as we get older, we also have different parts. We have that emotional part to us that is chaotic and orderly part. And the way it looks is something like this. I don't know if you can see that, but I hope you can. So the animal force is driven by impulse. It's egocentric normally, because emotions unguarded is all about me. Chaotic and reactionary, impulsive. There's also what happens is when we operate only within the world of chaos, there's no congruence. In other words, the different parts of our personality don't work well with each other. There's no synchrony between our mind, our heart, our behavior, and so on. And what happens is if we just leave ourselves in that world of chaos, we don't have any mastery, so we lose self-control. Right? However, we do have a part of us that's the godly force, as we've talked about many times, which is not driven by emotion, it's driven by intellectual decision making, which is not impulsive. And therefore it's able to be selfless and can submit to something higher than ourselves. It's orderly, it's calm, and therefore proactive. We make decisions, we think, and then we act. And it brings synchrony. It's able to bring different parts of our personality together properly, and therefore we can achieve mastery and self-control, and we can actually act in a calm way and a masterful way, a controlled way. Now, that's just a little bit, I mean, that's a discussion in its own right, but I want to just bring that in so we understand a little bit how we work, right? So going back to the model we said before, where we have the subconscious, which we talked about last week, the conscious and the emotion. As I said, the subconscious and the emotions, what happens is they both team up, and they're both impulsive, and they're both irrational. So therefore, step one, to getting in control of our emotions is to take back control of the conscious mind in a healthy way. Right? That's what we have to do. In other words, the conscious mind has to call the shots. It might use the subconscious, but the conscious mind has to call the shots, because it's the conscious minds that will bring, and we're going to demonstrate how that works. The conscious mind has to bring control, has to bring guidance, has to bring maturity, has to bring mastery, has to bring congruence, synchrony to the whole process. When we do that, we can still use the emotions, we can still use the subconscious when we need to, but we will live a much more of a controlled life, and a life where we engage in healthy emotion and achieve the goals that we actually want to achieve in a meaningful and purposeful way. Now, to do that, right, see, the subconscious, which plays tricks on us, which is the hard drive, which stores everything that's ever happened to us, as we said, is irrational and impulsive and links up with the emotion. Am I making sense, everyone following this? Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So the subconscious links with the emotion. The conscious mind has to take control, but it has to link with something else. And that's something we didn't bring in last week, and that's this. The essence of the person. Okay. So that's the full picture of the person. Similar to the five levels we sometimes talk about, but in the context of this discussion, it's this, right? So the essence of the person, which we'll talk about in a couple of moments, has to drive the conscious and pre-conscious, and then it will bring control and health and maturity to every single part of us, both the subconscious and the emotion. Yep, we're okay so far? Yep. Now, what does it all mean? So in the past, we've looked at many, many strategies and many, many different things that have to do with mindset shifts and how we train our conscious mind to have the proper thinking patterns in the thinking process, right? But today, let's talk about one that's very, very fundamental, which we've talked about in different ways before, but doing a bit of a different context today. And it's in this chapter in Rabbi Twersky's book, which is a strategy or a mindset which he refers to as, and it needs to be clarified properly, but he refers to as something called assertiveness, to be assertive. What does he mean? So he says, normally throughout the day, what we do is, as we said before, we react, right? We react the whole time to the outside world, which when we do react, hopefully it's driven by some sort of thought pattern, but we react emotionally, but it's driven by a mindset. And the way we react is divided into three parts. Either it's passive, in other words, we don't react. Let's say someone provokes us or upsets us, or we're going through a challenge or whatever the case is, or we get asked to do something, we're completely passive and we just let ourselves go with the flow. Or we're aggressive, or in the middle, there's assertive. And what he submits in this chapter is the importance of assertiveness, importance of learning the art of being assertive. But assertiveness is something we have to learn and understand what that actually is. Because there's what assertiveness is, and it's what's driving the assertiveness, right? So just to read you a paragraph, he says, assertiveness does not mean being adamant about one's opinion or refusing to give an inch. It does not mean being stubborn. It does not mean being insisting on getting our own way. But his definition, a simple definition, tells us that assertiveness means being direct, honest, respectful when interacting with other people, and understanding that we have the right to express ourselves as long as we're respectful and do not hurt other people. Now, let's understand this, right? Often people resist being assertive because they feel maybe that's not refined, that's not proper good character. In other words, giving in all the time is a better character trait, for example, right? Now, there's a point we've made hundreds of times, but actually I just recently found it through a quote of Rabbi Twersky in one of the great sages, a 16th century Spanish sage called Rabbeinu Yonah. And Rabbeinu Yonah says, he talks about ga'ava, which is arrogance, haughtiness, right? And he says the following, which is something we've said many, many times, it's obvious, but it's beautiful to find it in such an early source. He says that the Baal Gaiva, which means the arrogant, haughty individual, is actually a person who has tremendous feelings of inferiority and therefore compensates for those feelings by convincing him or herself that they are superior to other people, right? Something we've talked about many, many times, linked to the whole idea of what real self-esteem is. That self-esteem is not a contradiction to the concept of humility. On the contrary, someone who's humble is someone who feels okay about themselves and therefore doesn't need to be superior to others, doesn't need to put down other people. In other words, being superior or inferior to other people, the feelings of inferiority or superiority is really the same disease. That's what it is. It just expresses itself in different people in different ways. Being strong, having an inner strength, in other words, being humble is not being weak. That's the point that he starts to talk about in getting to the concept of assertiveness. Being humble is not being weak, because sometimes we are called upon to be strong and do things that maybe seem strong. Like King Saul, who was called upon by God to fight a war and to defeat the nation of Amalek, and he didn't do that. And God sent the prophet Samuel to tell him, what is going on with you? It was your weakness clothed and cloaked in compassion and kindness, which was misplaced and inappropriate. Because as a leader, you should have done what you needed to do. You should have stood up when you were supposed to stand up and defeated the war as you were supposed to do it, right? So therefore, sometimes, you know, the Talmud says like this, right? Obviously, and we can talk about it again in a few minutes, but sometimes the idea of not being strong is a virtue. Sometimes of being extremely humble is a virtue. For example, and we'll come back to this in a minute, the Talmud talks about an amazing thing. The Talmud says that one of the greatest levels that a person could reach is shomin cherpatam ve'einam meshivin. That when someone heaps insult onto you, not to respond. Talmud says when a person gets screamed at or insulted or offended by someone and doesn't respond, that's one of the greatest things on the one hand. On the other hand, we have many, many sources where we are taught not to be, to use the Yiddish expression, not to be like a shmata, right? Because that concept, that Gemara, that Talmud that says that it's such an unbelievable ideal not to respond when you're being insulted or offended, it actually doesn't mean that we should be a rag. It actually doesn't mean that we just keep ourselves as a doormat and therefore I'm not going to answer, I'm not going to rock the boat. That's not what it means. Because we'll see in a second what it does mean. Right? So let's clarify this. Because I think it's a thing which needs important, using Jewish values, it needs really, really great clarity, especially in the world that we live in, where often this is misguided or distorted a little bit. What do I mean? So if we talk about Jewish values, there's nothing greater than humility, right? There's nothing greater than selflessness. The Talmud is full. Berkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, about being selfless and being kind and putting ourselves on a side somewhere and sometimes and giving in, or that the concept they call in the ethics works, vitur, levater, they call it in Hebrew today, to give in, not to always have our way, to go beyond ourselves, to go out of our comfort zone to help other people and so on and so forth, right? It's an incredible Jewish value about not being wrapped in ourselves. That's where ego comes from. Ego comes from people who are completely wrapped in their own reality, which leads to extreme arrogance sometimes. The Talmud is full, pages and pages, of how it's so important not to be wrapped in ourselves, right? And therefore we need to be very, very careful, because sometimes in the self-help literature or the personal growth concepts, you know, we read about the importance of taking care of ourselves and having me time and having things, you know, fit with us and should sit well with us and all these kind of things. We have to be very, very careful how we deal with that, because if it comes from an egocentric perspective, it's unhealthy. If it comes from being wrapped in ourselves, it's actually destructive rather than being constructive. The answer is yes, we do need to take care of ourselves and we do need to create boundaries, but we have to be very careful where it comes from, and that's where the whole idea of assertiveness comes from. So for example, let's explain it this way. The real definition of assertiveness means like this. When we're passive or aggressive, either one, what we're doing is we're responding because of the experience that we're responding to. What do I mean? So one of the problems with lack of self-esteem or arrogance or passivity, whatever the case is that we become obsessed with the perception of other people, right? Robert Twersky talks about this a lot. He talks about a lot exactly from his own experience. He says that until quite a mature age, he discovered later that he suffered from a very, very strong dose of lack of self-esteem. Even though he was a successful doctor and he ran an alcoholics rehabilitation center and he was a good psychiatrist and the whole thing. Why? Because he realized after a while that he was running his life to impress others. He was running his life to please others. And his whole life was about that. And that was becoming a workaholic and he wasn't taking care of himself or his family and so on and so forth, right? So whether we're passive, and I'll just give in to everything, or we're aggressive is also about being affected by the perception of others. Why? Because when someone criticizes me or someone asks me for a favor, for example, and I'm aggressively say no, it's because I'm uncomfortable with, you ask me to do this, I'm going to say no, you're going to think I'm this, so I bash you up, right? So I start rejecting you in order to keep you out of the picture, right? Because I don't want you in my world, I don't want you to think, to interact with me and to think that I'm a bad person because you wanted to interact or you wanted to ask me to do something and I said no, and so on and so forth. Being passive is the same word. Always saying yes, the inability to ever say no also comes from that. It comes because I can't say no because what's the other person going to say? In other words, when I run my life based on what society or people or the circumstances around me are going to think or say or perceive or interpret, that's unhealthy and destructive and will result in one of two things, being passive or being aggressive, either one. Assertive means responding with clarity and morality from within. In other words, assertive means that I have the self-confidence to respond in an appropriate way, irrespective of what you're going to think. Not to say that other people's perceptions aren't important, sometimes they are, but nevertheless, what's driving me and the decision-making process that I'm taking control of in the consciousness of my mind is based on what is the right thing to do. Now, what is right to do often is being very selfless and being very kind and going out of myself, and that's fine. But we have to strive for selflessness, compassion, kindness, giving, helpfulness, not being wrapped in myself, all of these things, they should come from a strength, not from a weakness. They should come from assertiveness, not from passivity. Does that make sense? Yeah? So let me give you a very, very simple example that he gives in his book. Ah, here we are. So his example is like this. I'll read you his example and then we'll discuss it. So he says, it's 6 p.m. and an acquaintance asks you to drive him to the airport, right? Now, because you're unable to refuse an unreasonable request, assuming it's not a true emergency, it's not an emergency, but right? So you don't call home and you just drive the person to the airport. That's a person who can't say no, right? A passive person. So he's talking to a male. He says, your wife and children are waiting for you and your wife has invited a friend to join you for dinner, right? You disappoint them coming home after 8 p.m. and finding them upset. So that's an extreme example, but always to clarify things, you bring extreme examples, right? So that's okay. So let's take that example. And let's talk about the three types of responses that can happen. So at 6 p.m. and this person asked me to take him to the airport, right? Now, I really shouldn't because I've got someone at home waiting, and so on. So the passive response is a person who can never say no. Oh, if I say no, he's going to be upset. What's he going to think about me? So we say yes, right? We all do this a lot in our lives. We're scared of other people. We don't want to disappoint other people. We're scared of our own kids sometimes, right? So we don't say no. We don't. And by the way, it's an irrational decision, because the truth is we're going to be even more trouble later when we get home when we disappointed six people, not just one person. But it doesn't matter. On the spot, I'm just weak. So therefore, on the spot, I'm responding. Because normally that's what happens, by the way. People live their lives by the perception of other people. Actually, it's an irrational thing to do. So therefore, don't plan. They just respond to the moment, right? It's an impulsive response. It's a bad response. Now, sometimes a person would say no, but do it aggressively. In other words, why do people respond aggressively sometimes, besides having an aggressive nature? Sometimes because, like, I'm even upset you asked me. Like, why do you have to put me in that position? Yeah. Like, I've got to be home, and I'm in trouble. My wife isn't home, and there's a guest waiting for me. You know, you serious? Or you don't know that to ask someone to do this without any warning at 6 o'clock in the evening is a ridiculous thing to do? Come on, go find someone else to do it, right? That would be an aggressive response. But essentially, it's the same response. It's coming from what's going on outside of me. It's not coming from within. It's not coming from a clear, measured, decisive response of what is the right thing to do, right? It's coming from an impulsive response about having turmoil in my mind. What's going to be at home? And I can't say no. I'm not interested. I don't really want to take the person. You know, all this kind of stuff goes on, and you end up blurting out a response, which is often hurtful. You get out of it, but you hurt him in the process, right? That's an aggressive response. What's an assertive response? So an assertive response, and again, it doesn't have to take a half an hour to come out with a response. It's a training, I suppose. We have to develop a mindset or a focus or an attitude, right? The assertive response is to respond from within. What is the right thing to do? Now, there's a few things that are right to do. It's right to help other people. It's right to be respectful to other people, right? Never to put other people down. It's right also to keep to our priorities and our loyalties and weigh up conflicting priorities. Now, if my wife's at home and she's invited four guests, it is completely wrong and disrespectful not to show up on time, right? But it's also disrespectful to hurt this individual. He's obviously got a need. He needs to go to the airport. Maybe something came up. So an assertive response is also a no, but it's a completely different kind of no. It's a no from within. You follow me? In other words, it's a respectful no. It could go something like, I'm really, really sorry. I would love to do it at any other time. Unfortunately, I have to say no because I've got someone waiting at home. If I sense the person is in trouble, I could say, you know what, actually, do you want me to try help you get an Uber or a taxi or something like that? And, you know, if it's a person maybe that can't afford it, maybe I can help them out with a taxi if I'm a kind person, right? You see the difference, right? The difference is not just the way I'm saying it, the difference is where it's coming from. Assertiveness comes from within. Assertiveness comes from having the strength and the humility together to be able to use the consciousness of my mind, not to let the subconscious get in the way, not to get my weak, fragile emotional state get in the way, but to let my mind control my decision making in a moral, clear, well thought out way. Right? That's a simple example, but life is full of this all the time. And therefore, it's taking control of my emotion and still striving for humility, still striving for compassion, still striving for selflessness, but yet doing what's right, and sometimes having the strength to say, no, I've got to now do something else, and helping in the best way I could. But it's coming from within, it's coming from a strength, and it's coming with clarity. Yeah.
What happens when a person is assertive, like this definition, and the other person, it does not receive it
well.
But they're too close to ignore their...
So it's a great question. Normally with time, people, if it's genuine, people do receive it well. But the main thing is this. It's a great question, because if I'm assertive in the true sense of the world, right, where it's not egocentric, it's coming from a good place, coming from a real strength, and it's done respectfully, underlined three times, right, then at least I know I've done the right thing. Because sometimes we are in a quandary of what to do. And sometimes we get into life situations where we're not going to make everyone happy all the time. It's just what it is. But it depends how we do it. And that's exactly where we need to reclaim the consciousness of the mind. Not to let the hard drive of the subconscious get in the way. Not to let other people get in the way. Not to let outside perceptions get in the way. Not to get our weak, fragile insecurity of our emotions get in the way. But to have the clarity and the morality to be able to do it strongly. and respectfully. So let's give a couple of just thoughts which are around this idea. In a few weeks, we're going to have the festival of Shavuot. We've said this idea before, but it fits right into this idea. And on Shavuot, we commemorate the ultimate experience of the Jewish nation, which is the receiving of the Torah on Mount Sinai. And we know that the Talmud tells us that the Torah was given on a mountain. I don't think it was that mountain, by the way. But the Torah was given on a mountain, and the Mount Sinai. Why? Because the Mount Sinai was a symbol of humility, because it was a low mountain. It was lower than all the other mountains. So the obvious question the commentaries ask, well, if you're looking for something low, and you're looking for a symbol of humility, so find a valley. Why a mountain? And the answer is that humility is not a valley. It's not a deep hole. Humility is a mountain. It's a small mountain, but it's a mountain of strength. And that's that balance, and that's that combination, that I'm humble because my humility comes because I understand who I really am. And I understand I have an objective, and I have a moral compass, and I have a direction and a goal of where I'm going to live a good and meaningful and purposeful and moral life. And therefore, sometimes that humility means that I'm not egocentric. Humility means I can make plenty of room for others, but also means I have a strength. And I know when to use it and when not to use it. It's not coming from a weakness. It's coming from a place of strength. Because true humility must come from a place of strength. And that's why, yes, a low mountain, but a mountain nonetheless. And that goes into something which I mentioned briefly in the Parsha share on Tuesday morning, but I want to go through it again. Something that happens in this week's Parsha, which is by divine providence. It's a concept in this weekly portion which just fits in so beautifully to this idea. So we have, I've called it the cedar wood and the hyssop idea. But in this week's parasha, we have a very, almost a painful idea, which is the idea of tzara'at, which is normally mistranslated as leprosy. It's not exactly leprosy. It's almost a combination of a spiritual and physical skin disease that only happened in ancient times or biblical times, temple times, and so on. And we are taught in the Talmud that it comes almost as a punishment. It's called a nega, a plague that was given to people for gossiping and talking lashon hara and creating division between people. Right? Now, the Torah treats this idea of tzara'at pretty severely. It doesn't happen today. Probably, thank God. Lashon hara is a very big test, and if it happened to everyone that spoke lashon hara, it could be a little bit of a problem. But it doesn't happen today. God took it away. However, it happened then, and it would create a state of impurity. And the laws of someone who developed this tzara'at on his skin or her skin was quite strict. What that person had to do was to go to a kohen. The kohen would then examine the person, because there were different colors and depending how it developed. And there were some times that the kohen declared that in fact the disease that the person has is in fact tzara'at, and that person is impure. Now, what was the ramification of that person becoming impure? So with this impurity, there are many different types of impurity in the Torah, but with this particular one, there was a quarantine process. It was an isolation process. So they lived in a community, like with a wall around it, as people used to live in those days. The person actually had to go out of the community to be isolated from the rest of the community, and, I don't know, camp outside the city walls until they got better. Right? Part of that idea, of course, was that you got this disease because you gossiped and created disunity and created division between people. Instead of people being together, you've caused people to be alone and divided from each other. Therefore, you need to experience that loneliness that you've caused by going outside the city, right? That's one of the ideas. Now, then this week, by the way, happens to be a double portion. It's Tazria and Mitzara, because the second part of the portion talks about the purification process of what happens when a person becomes pure, right? How does it work? What's the process? So the Torah tells us that when the person realizes that on their skin this thing is cleared up after a few weeks or whatever it is, the time, they have to call for the Kohen to come back. The Kohen comes back and examines, and yes, it's been pure. And then there's a whole purification process. Part of that process is a whole sacrificial idea that involves taking two birds, but with the two birds, is a symbol of chattering. Had to do with why he got it in the first place. But the more important thing I want to talk about is that the Kohen has to take two things that grow from the ground. One is Eitz Erez, which is a piece of a cedar wood tree. And the other one is Azov, a hyssop plant. Right? I'm not even sure what it is, a hyssop plant, but it's a little plant, like a fragile little, on the right there. That's what a hyssop plant, at least according to Google, that's what a hyssop plant looks like. Right? That's the source of a lot of academic learning these days. So I saw, just by the way, I saw a very funny just little thing the other day. Nothing to do with what we're talking about, but just because I said that Google's a source of a lot of learning. I saw someone, a great rabbi, writing the other day. He says that people have to be careful how they teach Jewish law and how they share Jewish ideas. And he said that, you know, nowadays, it comes from a lot of learning, and you have to learn for a lot of years and really be knowledgeable. You can't just jump onto a computer program, onto Google, and look up a question and then say the answer. People do this in the medical field also, and everyone becomes a medical expert, an halachic expert, and everyone, why? Because, you know, you tap into Google and you see the answer, and that's the authoritative answer, right? So this person is writing that you shouldn't do that. So then he says that now dawned on him what the Talmud said. The Talmud says that it's a whole discussion of the Talmud about Shabbat. So it says that even someone who's not knowledgeable, like even someone that the doesn't lie on Shabbat. There's a thing about the Torah, about trusting someone. It says on Shabbat you can trust them because they respect Shabbat enough not to lie on Shabbat because they're kind of like scared of the Shabbat. He says, you never understood what it means, they're scared of the Shabbat. Why would an ignorant person be scared of Shabbat? He says, now understands, because on Shabbat the person can't look up Google. That's why they're scared of Shabbat. Anyway, just by the way. Okay, so back to this. So in this week's parasha, so he says you've got to take two things, a part of a cedar tree, a branch of a cedar tree, and a hyssop plant. What's the idea? So we find very, very often in commentaries that the hyssop branch is a symbol of humility. It's a very fragile branch. It grows deep in the ground. And often we find the hyssop branch used other places in the Torah. Normally it's got to do with inculcating or nurturing the characteristic of humility. Now, this person who went through the tzaraat experience needs to learn to be humble. Why? Because this person was arrogant. The idea of causing disunity often comes together with, it's all part of the same thing. Why do people feel the need to gossip and to always talk about other people or what happened to other people, and did you hear what this one did and that one said, and this one looked and this one winked and this one who knows what, right? Normally it comes from our own insecurities. If the more secure we were, the more happy we'd be with ourselves, the less we'd find the need to cause disunity with other people by just chattering and talking about them unnecessarily, right? So the person who spoke Lashon Hara or gossiped or caused division between people, often that, more than often, it originates from haughtiness, from a lack of humility, and therefore a person to understand that sort of process and a consequence of what they've done need to learn humility, which was very much taught to the person with Tzaraat by going through that period of isolation. That was a crushing experience and normally humiliating experience, and that was good for the person, so to speak, right? So therefore the Kohen brings the Torah, says a hyssop branch, to remind the person that we hope you've learned from this experience, and we hope that going forward you will focus on the concept of humility. But at the same time the Torah says, with the hyssop branch you must take a cedar branch. Eitz Erez, the cedar tree, often in Talmud and in verses in Tanakh, is a symbol of towering strength. Because what the Kohen has to teach this person is the following. We hope you've learned humility, but in the true way. Because there's a danger. The danger is that you've gone through a humiliating experience and you might have been crushed, and maybe you've learned to become humble, but not necessarily you've learned the right humility. Because being crushed doesn't always result in the right humility. Being crushed sometimes results in transferring arrogance into inferiority. And that doesn't make a humble person. And therefore, you haven't learned anything. In other words, we teach the person that although you've gone through a tough and painful experience with Yotzarat, use it out, learn from it, inculcate humility, but humility with strength. Because humility, true humility, is assertiveness. True humility must come from strength. Yes, humble you must be, but like a cedar tree with an inner strength. And that's why there's the Azov, there's the Hyssop, together with the cedar tree. They're two opposite things. Very, very different, but yet to achieve true humility, they must come together. There must be that softness and that fragility of a hyssop branch, which is true humility, together with the strength, the towering strength of the cedar tree. And that's what Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, that's what God was telling him. King Saul was known as a very humble person, to the point that when God came to look for him, when Samuel the prophet came to look for him by instruction of God to appoint him the king, he hid. He was nowhere to be found. Why? He ran away from leadership, which is a good thing. A person should be scared of being a leader, but not to overdo it. Moses himself was punished for that. Moses himself at the burning bush argued with God for 7 days. He doesn't want to go take the people out of Egypt, not because he didn't want, he was lazy, but because he didn't think he was fit. And God said, that's okay now. The first few days, I understand. It's a good thing. It's good to be humble. It's good not to jump into, into a position of leadership. It's good to know and to be scared of leadership. But to avoid it completely, to argue with me for 7 days, that's overdoing it, because the call of the hour is you need to go and do it. You need to have the strength to go and do it. Be humble when you do it, but do it. King Saul was humble. That was a fantastic thing. The Torah glorifies that characteristic. But when he didn't stand up and deal with Amalek the way he was supposed to do it, God said that was misplaced humility. So it needs the hyssop together with the cedar branch to come together. How do we achieve all of this? How do we achieve this assertiveness, this response coming from inside within, driven by the conscious mind? So first of all, the conscious mind is the key. It's very, very important. Reflection. We always have to reflect before we respond. We always have to think what is the right thing to do, not without distraction or influences by the subconscious, the hard drive of the subconscious, or other people or other influences. Moses, there's a story in the Torah where Moses was challenged by Korach, the famous rebellion, right? Where in that rebellion, actually, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, responded quite harshly to Korach. But if you look carefully in the verses, it says that when Korach came and he challenged the whole leadership structure and he undermined the whole Sinai revelation, it says, Vayipol Moshe, Moses fell on his face for a period of time, and then got up and gave it to Korach in a very assertive way. So the commentary said, what does it mean he fell on his face? Why did he fall on his face? So one of the ideas is, because he didn't want to respond right away. He wanted to think first. He wanted to reflect first. He had to think. It had to be coming from the conscious mind. And he had to be sure, Moshe Rabbeinu had to be sure that his response was pure. Why? Because in that story, Korach challenged him. And Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't prepared to respond, lest he maybe came from being hurt or being offended by Korach. Now, it wasn't a problem for Moshe Rabbeinu because he was humble. He probably didn't, it wasn't coming from that. But he had to be sure, he had to reflect, he had to go through it. And sometimes we can't be sure. Sometimes we have to talk to other people. Sometimes we have to talk to a mentor, to a friend, to make sure that our responses are selfless, are coming from the right place, and they're not being influenced by other factors, right? It's not so easy always. Moshe Rabbeinu was able to fall on his face, reflect, go through a whole process, and then got up and responded. So reflection and think and review is a very, very important thing. But there's another important thing. And that is the confidence in ourselves. And that's where the linkage between the conscious, not the subconscious, but the essence comes in. We've talked about this many times. We have to believe assertiveness is not easy. It's easier to be passive, non-confrontational, just be passive all the time. And it's also easier sometimes to be aggressive for some reason. Some people find it more easy to be aggressive than to be assertive, respectfully assertive, right? Because assertive is a very big balance. It's combining lots of things together. You've got to combine strength, humility, respect, conflicting priorities all in one in order to come up with a clear and appropriate response. That's difficult. It needs amazing strength of the conscious mind, decision-making ability, inner strength, and so on and so forth. That's difficult. But we have to believe that at the end of the day, what drives us? Who are we really, as we've spoken about so many times? We're beyond the subconscious. We have that inner strength. We have that purity. We have that essence of the soul that can do it. That was the difference between those two stories in the Chumash about the spies. Moses sent spies to conquer the land of Israel. It was a disaster. Joshua sent spies. He was very successful. Why? They were both going in a challenging mission. They were both trying to strategize. They were both observing the exact same complicated land. The difference was the spies of Moses believed they couldn't do it. The spies of Joshua says we can do it. So it was a matter of not if we can do it, it's a matter of how we're going to do it. That's very different. That's the whole difference. We too, we don't just have the conscious mind. Our subconscious, the irrational subconscious, links with the irrational emotion. But our conscious mind links above with our essence, with who we really are. with the spark of morality, with the spark of purity that we have. It also links with that part of us, that spark that can transcend and bring together opposites. It can bring together humility and strength. It can bring together being very humble but being strong at the same time. That, we've talked about this before, that rests in the essence of the soul. That rests in the transcendent part of us that can be above the chesed and the gevurah, can be above the chokhmah and binah, can bring together the both parts, can bring together different parts of our personality to be able to respond in a proper way. So therefore, that's the first part, the first step of making proper decisions within our conscious mind in order to respond to the outside world and to live an effective and meaningful life and to live a motivated life and to manage our emotions in a healthy, mature way so that we don't do, and we'll talk about this next week, that we don't make irrational decisions and do the things that achieve the very opposite of what we're trying to achieve, like happiness and so on. The first stage is to take control of the conscious mind, link it to the real belief in our abilities coming from the essence of who we are, and learn to respond to the outside world by reflecting and pausing and being proactive rather than reactive, making the decisions with a combination of humility and strength, with respect and humility, and responding from a place of strength rather than a place of weakness. Next week we'll expand it more to understand how it relates to all the other things. Have a great week. Just a reminder that we've started the raffle, so those who want to buy a raffle ticket, please see the office.